Welcome to the Hardware Roadmap course. In this in-depth course, I'm going to take you all the way from having a product idea all the way through manufacturing. We're going to be covering a lot of material in this course. It's broken down into four modules. Module one, we're going to look at the research stage. So looking at the competition and validating the product to make sure that this is something worth pursuing before we go on to the second stage, or module two is the planning stage. Once you've validated the product and you've decided that this is worthwhile to pursue, now you need to come up with a plan on how you're going to bring this to market. In module three, we're going to look at the product design stage. This is where you'll design the electronic circuits, the printed circuit board, the enclosure design, the package design. So we're going to be looking at that in module three. And then finally in module four, we'll be looking at the prototyping stage. Once you've got your initial design, your schematic circuit and your printed circuit board layout and your 3D model, now it becomes the prototyping stage and the testing debug stage. Then once you're through with the prototyping stage, then you are ready to begin the manufacturing setup. Okay, so let's jump right into module one, which is the research stage. And the very first step in the research stage is to validate your product idea. Unfortunately, this is an area where a lot of entrepreneurs, they skip over this part. A very typical flow is that you have an idea, you maybe do a quick research to make sure that it's not already a patented idea or a product that you've seen on the market. And as soon as you don't see that there's any competition for it, then the typical flow is okay, you've done your market research and now you're ready to jump right into developing and making a prototype. And I'm going to show you that that's not the way to do it. Instead, it's much better to fully validate the product and make sure that this is really worth pursuing, because all these other stages, the design and prototyping stages, they're a lot of work. It's a lot of money, a lot of time you're going to spend. It's really worthwhile that you spend this time up front to validate that the product is a good one. And one of the ways to do that is you research the competition. Now, this is where most people have it backwards. They think researching the competition, they think it's a good thing if they find no competition. I mean, you don't want any competition, right? That would be the way of thinking, but that's actually wrong. Ideally, you want a product that has some competition, but it's competition that you feel like you can do better than them. And the reason this is by having competition, they've proven that there's a market for this product. If you see another company out there that has a product that's similar to your idea and you can tell that they're selling them and making some money, then they've done some of the validation for you. They've validated that there's a market for this. And now you just have to do a better job at serving that market than the competition. Whereas if you do a search and you don't find any competition, then that may not be a good thing. It means that no one has validated this before. You're going to be taking a much higher risk by being the one to try to bring this to market and to validate it. This is exactly why a lot of times it's best to be the second to market and not the first to market. There are lots of examples of this throughout product development history of people that made it to market second were the ones that ultimately succeeded, because they were able to capitalize on what was learned by the first company that was the first to market. If you can be the second to market, then you can learn all the things that the first company did and you can improve those, and then you can do your product introduction and actually beat out the competition that was already there. But it's really important to have some competition up front. It's not always required. I mean, there are some, really innovative ideas where it may be totally unique. No one has ever done this before. And I'm not going to say don't pursue that, but just be aware that that's going to be a higher risk, potentially a higher payoff if it's a truly innovative idea that no one has ever done. But just be aware that by being the first, you're the one taking the risk. In so many ways, it's better to be second. If I'm going to climb Mount Everest, I don't think I would want to be the first person to ever do it, because there's so many unknowns and so much risk associated with it. It would be much better to be the second, regardless of whatever that activity is, because now someone has proven it's possible, and that just naturally lowers the risk for you. Start off with research the competition and ideally find some competition that's got something similar, but that you think you can do a better job on executing than they can. The second step to validating your idea is you have to be able to share your idea. There's no way you can validate an idea if you keep it totally in your head. You cannot be overly secretive. That is the worst case thing that you can do when bringing a product to market, is to be overly secretive. I've never known any product to fail because they weren't secretive enough, or that has failed because someone stole their idea before they were able to get it to market. It just doesn't happen. That's so low probability of happening. The greater probability is you don't get feedback from others, you don't seek out help from others, and you try to do all this inside your own head, and you ultimately never even make it to market because there's so many obstacles that you're not even aware of, or that you bring a product to market that no one wants because you didn't validate the idea up front because you were too secretive. Don't be overly secretive. No one steals unproven product ideas. They wait until you prove it and validate it and actually have some revenue generated by it. Then that's when they'll be interested in trying to copy. But by then, you'll have a head start and you can just focus on outperforming them. But I understand the desire to be secret with your idea. I was in that boat with my own product. I totally get that. But if that's a concern with you, then there are ways around that. First of all, I would recommend that you get a provisional patent, or more technically correct, a provisional patent application. But a normal patent, a utility patent, will cost you probably at least $10,000. You'll need an attorney. You can expect to take a year or more, sometimes years, to get the patent. It's a very involved process, and it's never something I recommend that you do early on. It's just too much of a drain on your time and your finances and your energy when you really need to be focusing on the market and the customer and meeting the demands and the needs of the market and not on your idea or protecting it. But what you can do is you can go with the provisional patent application, and this will give you protection in the U.S. Other countries may have something similar, but this is in the U.S. I'm referring to the provisional patent application, and that will give you protection for 1 year for your product. And the cost is only, we're only talking a couple hundred dollars to get a provisional patent application. You do not need an attorney. There's no really complicated paperwork or documentation that's required like there is for a full patent. It's just a pretty simple form that you'll fill out on the United States Post Patent and Trademark Office. And it's something you can get really quickly. Start there. And what this will do is it will give you, protect your idea for 1 year. And then at the end of that 1 year, you should have been able to validate your idea and make some progress. And you can decide at that point, do you want to proceed with getting a full patent and going down the route of hiring an attorney and spending significantly more money? That's one route. Definitely get a provisional patent no matter what. I mean, it's a no-brainer. It's so cheap and it will give you 1 year of protection. The other thing you can do is to use non-disclosure agreements with anyone that you share this with. There's a template for this inside the resource section inside the academy that you can use. And that can be a good way to eliminate the risk of you sharing something that you don't have patented with other people that you're looking to get feedback to validate your ideas. A non-disclosure agreement can be one way to do that. But in general, don't worry too much about being secretive and protecting your idea. That's what every entrepreneur does when they have an idea, is they focus on protecting it. And like I said, that's once you've been through this process and all the real obstacles and the things that are going to be really difficult for you to overcome, you realize that the whole secret aspect of it is just such a low probability. And yet there's a 0.1% chance that someone stealing your idea is what's going to make your company a failure. But yet that's what most people will focus 99% of their attention on, is protecting that idea when that's not really a significant risk. You have to share your idea to get feedback. You cannot, there's just no way to validate a product if you're not willing to share that to seek out feedback from others. In addition to getting feedback from the end user or potential end users, you also should get feedback from any retailers, distributors, or sales representatives that work in your industry. For instance, if you have an electronic product, of course, you could go to your local Best Buy and talk to the manager there and just show him your product idea, perhaps a prototype if you have it, depending on your stage, but just seek out and get their feedback. They're still just one person, and you can only put so much confidence in the opinion of one person, but they're one person that has a lot of experience in, you know, retail sales of your type of product to know what does well and what doesn't do well. That can be a really good strategy. And keep in mind, a lot of these store managers, they tend to be very busy. They're not going to want to give you a whole lot of time. You may have to visit a few stores before you can find one that's going to be really helpful. But this can be really useful data. It will tend to be very unbiased data, but a very educated data as well, since they have so much experience in retail sales. You can do the same thing with distributors of the product or sales representatives if you can find them. But obviously, retail shops or are more customer, consumer facing, they're easier for you to find. That's where I would start. And you can even talk to the retailers and also ask them what distributors and sales reps that they use while you're having this conversation. And then you can reach out to those distributors and sales reps to get their feedback. And then also in the future, they'll be good resources for when you're ready to actually start selling the product. Another way that you can validate your product idea is by building a proof of concept prototype. This is typically a prototype that you build using an Arduino or Raspberry Pi and off-the-shelf components, you know, potentially a breadboard, you know, in some cases. But generally, it's going to be off-the-shelf boards that you'll connect together using a development kit of some sort. This can be really good for validating that your product solves the intended problem, but validates the concept of your prototype, but it doesn't necessarily on its own validate that there's an interest or that your product will actually do well in the market. But a proof of concept, regardless of that, is still very useful to prove your concept. But you can also use this proof of concept, especially if you have a product where you're able to make the proof of concept prototype look pretty similar to a final prototype. It can't just have an Arduino and wires sticking out everywhere. You've got to have a neat enclosure and everything enclosed inside of there. Then you could use your proof of concept prototype to get feedback from other people. That's one way to use the proof of concept prototype to validate your idea, is to get it to a point where it's presentable and show it to people. It may not be to the level that you're willing to use this to seek out investments yet from angel investors and such, but it can be a good way to get some very early feedback and validate your product idea. Next, we're going to talk about building an audience. And this becomes such a critical aspect of everything that you're going to do in regards to validating your idea, but in regards to marketing it and developing it and then eventually selling it. Building an audience is going to be key. In fact, this is so important that I'll be doing a really in-depth training course just on building an audience. But it's essential that you start as early as possible building an audience. It takes a long time to build an audience. And what most people do is they start with their focuses on a working prototype. They'll spend 1 to 2 years doing that. Then they'll begin thinking about, okay, now I've got a prototype. Then they'll start thinking about marketing and perhaps building an audience, because they don't really think, how can I build an audience if I don't have a prototype yet? But that's the wrong way of thinking. You need to start building your audience from day one. As soon as you do some of the very early validation steps for your idea, then start building an audience. And it does not have to be, you don't have to start selling your product to this audience. So you don't even have to mention your product. In fact, you shouldn't probably mention your product. What you want to do is you want to provide valuable free information, content for people that you think could potentially want to buy your product in the future. When building an audience, the first step, I'm going to just cover these really quickly. And like I said, there'll be a more in-depth training course in the future. But the first step is you have to create a website. You know, that's everything kind of begins in business. For online business, you need a website, obviously. Then the next step is, once you have a website, you need to create a blog or provide some type of free valuable content. It doesn't have to be a blog, which is mainly written words, but you could start a podcast or a YouTube channel. The point is you have to focus on just providing immense value, and you just have to give, give, give without taking. And you have to do that for quite a while. Typically 6 months to 2 years is what you can expect it to take to build an audience. That's why you should do this from day one and simultaneously while you develop your product is be building your audience. Once you've created this blog and you've got all this great content, then Google will start sending you targeted traffic to your website. And then you'll need to start collecting email addresses of those people that are interested in your content. And then that's how you'll build up your audience. Your audience should be essentially a list of email addresses. Don't over-focus on social media. Instead, focus on building your audience of email addresses because that's where the power is for online, any type of online business. For instance, if your product is a pet-related product, well, then create a website and a blog where you talk about pets or pet ownership or pet dieting or pet walking or anything that relates to your product without just being pushy and talking about your product. Just educate the people and build up a relationship with them. It's always key for business, any type of business, whether that's online or one-to-one, you need a relationship first with the person. You can't just ask them out of the blue, buy my product. You need to focus on that relationship. Build that audience and focus on that relationship while you also build your product. Another example is if your product is music related, then write about teaching how to play an instrument or how to play an instrument. Just don't get stuck in the loop of thinking that you have to talk about your product to start building an audience. In fact, that's, like I said, that's the opposite. Start just educating them, just providing value without talking about your product. First of all, just doing this and the feedback you'll get from them, you will learn so much. And I suspect by the time your product hits the market, you'll have tweaked it based on a lot of the feedback that you're getting from your audience. And then that's going to make the product just that much better and that much more likely to sell. Once you have an audience, some of the other strategy you can do is you conduct surveys. Ask your audience. There's kind of two types of questions you can ask your audience. You can say, would you buy this product? This is one type of question. And then the other type of question is a little more open-ended, and that's seeking feedback on what type of product features, specifications would meet their needs. You can use this audience and the survey for gathering both of those pieces of information. Do keep in mind that a survey is going to be limited in regards to the question of, would you buy my product? Because until money is exchanging hands, there's not a whole lot of meaning behind someone saying, sure, I'll buy your product. First of all, it's just human nature to say yes to people or give them positive news. But in reality, there's no way you're going to buy this product. Or you may even say, yeah, sure, I would buy it. I think that would be useful. But then once it's finally available, you walk past it 100 times in the department store, never giving it a second look. Just be very cautious with using surveys. You may find you survey an audience and 70% of the people say they would buy your product. Well, it's not going to be that high. It's probably more likely 7%, not 70%. Just take these results with a grain of salt. Now, if you conduct a survey and you ask people, would you buy my product? And only one out of 100 people says yes, then that can be an indicator that you've got some serious problems and you want to rethink your market and your product. But in general, I tend to find that the better use of surveys is for getting feedback to improve your product based on feedback from your audience. Another technique that you can do to validate your product idea, and this is one that I believe I had seen recommended by Gary Vaynerchuk, and it's a little black hat, and if you know the term black hat, so it's a little bit sketchy, but I see the value in this, and it's really an easy thing to do, and I really see the value of it with validating hardware ideas. It's something that I want to discuss. Creating a sales page test, basically you want to create a page on your website that makes it seem like your product exists now and is for sale. So no coming soon or this is in development, but show a picture of the product ideally being used or just a picture of the product. But you want to make it seem like this is something that can be purchased right now. You have a big buy now button for $99.99, buy now. Even though you really, of course, don't have the product for sale. But what this allows you to do is allows you to measure real interest in people wanting to pay for your product. obviously the visitor, they don't know your product's not really for sale. When they hit that buy now button, that's a big indicator that they really want to buy your product and they want to put their money down. Still not the same as them actually giving you the money, you know, because plenty of people will add something to the shopping cart but then back out. But it still gives you really strong validation that people would buy your product. And it's great because it doesn't require that you even have a product yet. All you need is a sales page to test it. What you're going to need, though, is you obviously people probably want to see a picture of your product. And if you don't have the product yet, your option is you can hire a designer to create a photorealistic model of your product. It looks like the real product and not just, you know, a 3D model. It's photorealistic is the goal. Is people see it and they think it's just the product's available now and it's ready to go and I can purchase it. This can be a really good way, really quickly, to validate a new idea. Now, I wouldn't probably send, if you've already started building your audience, this is not something I would probably want to send my audience to because it is a little black hat. It's a little bit sketchy. In general, making people think something's available when it's not is probably not going to leave the best taste in their mouth when they're done. What I would do for this type of sales test is, or validation, is I would send cold traffic to it, and most likely just cold traffic from Facebook that you purchased. Set up a Facebook ad, send cold traffic to it. Ideally, you want cold traffic. You don't want them necessarily to have a relationship with you for two things. First of all, you want to find out how cold traffic responds to the product. That's kind of the main reason you would want to send cold traffic to it. You want just to find out how people that don't have a relationship with you respond to the product idea. The second reason you don't want to send warm traffic to it is, like I said, it's a little black hat. It's a little bit sketchy. So I wouldn't send your audience to it because you're going to kind of maybe, like I said, leave a bad taste in people's mouths. And that's not something you want to start with for any type of long-term relationship. Just send some cold, quick traffic to this from Facebook and then keep that separate from your audience. In addition to building an audience, which is mainly based on you providing just informative free content around the subject. You're not really talking about your product, especially early on. You're just building an audience of people that are interested in that category of topic, which could potentially translate into wanting to purchase your product. The other type of audience is more specifically a waiting list or wait list. These are people that have specifically specified an interest in your product and want to be notified more about it or when it's available. So this is obviously you're going to probably want to do this a little bit later once you've probably established a little bit of trust and you want to start sharing information about your product and you've got, you know, something on your website where you can start talking about your product. But just like with the audience, the sooner you can start building a waiting list, the better. Although if you start too early, there's going to be, if you start your waiting list on day one and it's 2 years later before your product is available, odds are a lot of those people on the waiting list may not be quite as anxious to buy the product as they were 2 years ago. But the key is, you know, just to keep in contact with them and keep that dialogue going until you do finally have your product ready for sale. But a wait list can be a really good way of validating your idea. It's a low form of commitment. They're not giving you any money. They're just giving you their email address. But that's something because they know most likely you're going to send them more email about your product. Them giving you their email address is some validation that they're interested in the product enough that they want to hear more about it. If you can build up a good size wait list, then that's going to be really pretty good validation that your idea is at least people are interested in it. The best way to validate any product is money has to exchange hands. The sales page test that we talked about, the black hat method, no money is exchanging hands, but that's a really easy second place because it has the illusion to the customer that money's going to exchange hands. That's much more better validation than, you know, someone just taking a survey, for instance, where there's no illusion that there's going to be any money exchanging hands. But the ultimate way to validate your idea is to pre-sell your product. So that means you want to sell the product before you've actually made it. And I know that can be, that's challenging, but ultimately it's going to be there's just no other way that's going to compare to validating your idea than having people put down money for your product before the product is even available to sell. Obviously, people in general don't want to pay for something months or especially years before it's going to be something they can purchase. This will require that you have a relationship with them and there's some trust between you and the subscriber. This is where your audience is going to really come through for you, is if you want to do pre-selling your product. What I would recommend, the easiest way to pre-sell a product is on your own website. Set something up where you can take payments or donations. Obviously, you want to offer them the best price that you'll ever have available for your product. The other great thing about pre-selling your product is not only is it the best form of validation that you can hope for, but it's also upfront money in your pocket. And when you're trying to build a new product, especially once you get to the point of, you know, needing to pay for inventory and things, having that money up front is going to be really beneficial. I think this is a really good strategy because you get both the validation and you get some money, but yet it's a lot simpler, a lot less complex than crowdfunding. And you can, you know, just do this simply through your own website, but it will require an audience. This will require that you have an audience and have developed some level of trust and relationship with your audience before they're going to be willing to give you money for something they may not see for months or years. Okay, next we're going to talk about building a minimum viable product. A minimum viable product, or MVP as they're commonly called, is the simplest, cheapest product that you can build and actually get on the market. But it's, in most cases, it won't be a proof of concept. It will need to be somewhat customized because it needs to be something that can be, you know, sold on the market and is really close to the final product that you want. But it's the simplest version of your product. No extra features, bells and whistles, anything that you think people may want isn't included. The only thing that should be on the MVP are the core functions that are absolutely required to solve your customers' problems. The reason you want to do an MVP is the goal is to get as quick as possible to what Eric Ries, who's the founder of, is it Ries or Ries? I'm not sure, but he's sort of the founder of the lean startup movement and the minimum viable product. But what he calls is the build, measure, learn loop. You build something, you get it in the market, you measure the results, you learn from those results, and then you loop back and put what you've learned back into the build cycle. And you keep looping through that until you end up with a product that is actually what people want. An MVP allows you to get to that testing, that build, measure, learn loop as fast as possible. Instead, a lot of people take the other route, which is to throw every conceivable feature into the product. And that's not a good way to go, because it's always a mistake if you think that you know what people want. Don't ever make that mistake. You can have a theory or a hypothesis that you want to test about what people want, but you have to think like a scientist. If you have an idea or hypothesis, don't consider it, you know, as true until you're able to test it. A minimum viable product is all about getting to that point where you can test it as soon as possible. Learn from that MVP, you'll learn what the market really wants, and then you can iterate on that MVP and add in the features that people actually want. As I'd mentioned, normally an MVP will not be your proof of concept prototype. Typically, it will need to be something that looks more like the final product. In most cases, there's going to be some level of custom design that's required to get to the MVP. But if you're fortunate enough to have a product that does bode well to being able to be made based off of off-the-shelf components and still look like a final production product, that's fantastic for you if you can use your proof of concept also as an MVP. But in most cases, the proof of concept is only for proving the concept and not necessarily for proving or validating that the product will sell. Just keep that in mind. And obviously, if you are selling a proof of concept using an Arduino and off-the-shelf components and selling it as your MVP product, you're going to have horrible profit margins. Odds are you're going to be selling the product at a loss, even perhaps a really huge loss. But the numbers are small and the data is so important that if you have to pay $100 for each unit and you're selling them for $50, obviously long term that's not sustainable, but in the early days that's totally fine. It's more important to get that real customer data as fast as possible. The final strategy we're going to look at for validating your idea, and it tends to be probably one of the best, but also one of the most complex, also the one that gets a lot of attention, is crowdfunding. The ultimate form of pre-selling is crowdfunding. And the beauty of crowdfunding, it's very similar to what I had mentioned before, pre-selling it on your own website, except this is obviously on a crowdfunding platform. And even though crowdfunding will be on a third-party platform like Indiegogo or Kickstarter, you cannot count on them to bring the traffic to you. You must bring the traffic yourself. Once again, there's no point in starting a crowdfunding campaign unless you have an audience, probably at least a few thousand people. You have to have your own audience to get that momentum going to be able to get the snowball effect building for your crowdfunding campaign, because no one wants to be the first to ever invest in a new product or pre-buy a new product. You have to bring your own, the people that you've developed a relationship and that trust you, you have to send those to your crowdfunding campaign. They'll make the first investments and get things going. And then once that happens, then other people that potentially just find you through Kickstarter or Indiegogo's own search platform, then they will be more likely to invest or to invest in your product. If you don't have an audience and you try to start a crowdfunding campaign, it will just be crickets and no one will show up. I tried that many years ago with my own products. Don't make that mistake. Focus instead on building an audience. And this is exactly what Pebble did many years ago when they were developing their smartwatch. They did exactly as I suggest. While they were building their prototype, they also were building their audience. And by the time they got to having a prototype they could present and use for crowdfunding, then they had an email list of somewhere around 3,000 to 4,000 people. Then they used that to get the momentum going on their Kickstarter crowdfunding campaign. And that got the initial energy going. And then ultimately they raised, you know, over $1 million and became the largest Kickstarter campaign in history at that point. But they've acknowledged themselves that having this email list or their own audience to send was absolutely essential to get things started. Okay, we've looked at a lot of different ways for you to validate your product idea, to research the market. I just want to reiterate, you cannot skip this step. The more forms of validation that you can do, the better you will be. The worst case scenario you do not want to do is spend years developing a product, tens of thousands of dollars getting it to market, and then finally find out that no one wants it. Spend this time up front. Don't get overexcited. Always remind yourself this is a long, long, long journey. This is a ultra marathon that you're running. Don't sprint past market research and product validation. Now we are ready for step two, and that is to define your product. Step three is going to be estimating the various costs, and then after that, planning, and then we'll get into the product design phase. But before you can obviously begin product design, you have to define the product. We're going to review some of the main characteristics of your product that you're going to need to define in order to be able to estimate all the different costs. And of course, to even get the product design, you have to have that defined for the developers. Now, some large design firms may have their own template that they would like you to use for sharing your product information. I'm going to be going over some of the general characteristics of a product that you'll need to specify or give some thought to and prioritize. The first one is start with describing the purpose of your product. Generally, for the product definition, I don't recommend that you go into detail about the market and how many people are going to buy your product. And that would be more for like a business plan. But for a product definition, stick to just the technical aspects and what the product is supposed to do. And of course, then the other specifications, but just don't be too verbose in this section and try to generally keep the purpose of the product simple. Usually just a paragraph or two should be sufficient for you to describe your product. Then next, we're going to break down the product into three parts, four if you count the packaging, but three for the product itself. We're going to be looking at, you have to specify the electronics, we'll specify the software, the firmware, and mobile apps. And then we'll specify the enclosure requirements or the mechanical design requirements. For the electronics, I recommend that you start off by listing all of the various features or functions of the electronics and list them in order of priority. For instance, you would list Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, accelerometers, cellular service. You would list all those broken down. And I'm going to pull up the form that I have online for predictable designs for having clients that share their project information with me. If you just go to predictabledesigns.com/specs, so SPECS, then that will show you the form that I use for collecting information about a product. You can see here are a list of a lot of the common functions for electronic products. Feel free to copy this to get some idea on the various features for your product and the electronic features. Do your best, and this is obviously more difficult if you're a non-technical founder, but do your best to keep the software and the hardware features separate. For instance, Bluetooth and Wi-Fi and cellular, those are the hardware features. But some of the specifics of, what the data that's communicated and how that's being communicated, that would be tend to be more in the software aspects. In general, try to differentiate between those two. It just makes it a little bit easier when you are trying to estimate your manufacturing costs, because software is obviously a lot different than hardware. Software complexity will increase your development costs, but not typically your unit cost. Be sure to keep those separate. So just list as many of the hardware features of your product as you can. And I know this is challenging if you're non-technical, but just do the best that you can. You can use this as a reference list of different features for a product, whether you have a display or touchscreen or camera or HDMI or various sensors. This can be a good starting place for getting an idea on the various features that you may want to specify for your product. Next, you're going to want to also specify your target retail price. And the reason this should be part of your product definition is this is going to set basically your upper end on your manufacturing cost. This can be really beneficial when development is happening for the component selection and prioritizing the performance specifications. For instance, if you're developing a $10 product versus a $100 product, the components that you're going to have to be able to use in each of those products are going to be drastically different. Obviously, the $10 product, you're going to be a lot more limited in the capabilities of the functions that you select, and you're going to have to obviously go with a much lower cost solution. That's really beneficial for the designer and who's doing the cost estimation. That's really beneficial to know that well in advance so that you can incorporate that knowledge into the component selection. Next is the product dimensions and the weight. How small is the product and how much do you anticipate it weighing? Now, you may not have exact specifications for the size and the weight because you don't really have the design yet to know what those are going to be. But what you can do is estimate or give a range that would be acceptable, and then also prioritize how critical is small size, for instance, or how critical is low weight. These can really add a lot of complexity to a product. Designing a product where size is super critical takes a lot more time, a lot more effort, which translates to more money to design than something where space is not a constraint. Because packing things tighter together, for instance, on the printed circuit board, that just takes more time. It's much easier to plop down different parts of the circuit with large spacing between them versus when you're packing things tight, then you have to measure everything and make sure that you're meeting the minimum spacing requirements for that printed circuit board process. But it just takes a lot more time. But it's really beneficial to specify upfront, estimate the size and the weight that you would like to target, but also specify how critical small size is and lightweight is for your product. Next, you'll want to look at the operating environment. Is this going to be operated in really cold temperatures? Is it going to be operated in the rain or high humidity environment? These are the types of things that you'll want to specify up front. Obviously, temperature, will be required to know because one of the key things that will determine is the battery type. For example, alkalines don't perform very well at all at cold weather. In a case like that, you'd probably want to go with some type of lithium battery. Obviously, if it's going to be in the water, then it needs to be waterproof. These are, you know, important things to identify up front. If it's just going to be used in a normal indoor environment, then that lowers the specification requirements. But if it's going to be used in any type of extreme environment, then you'll definitely want to specify that. Next is, how is the product going to be powered? Is it going to be battery powered? Is it going to be powered from an external DC source? Is it going to be powered from an AC outlet? And if it's battery powered, is it going to be a rechargeable battery or a disposable battery like an alkaline? But you want to specify those requirements up front. That's obviously really important. The majority of products that I see, by far the most common solution is a rechargeable battery with like a micro USB plug for recharging that battery. That's probably the most common, but obviously there's a lot of issues with rechargeable lithium batteries as far as safety and certification. Using a rechargeable battery can add a lot of complications for you. You may want to give some thought to starting off with using alkaline non-rechargeable batteries, but they have their own complications. You have to design the mechanical enclosure so the customer can access the batteries and change them out. That adds some other complexity. So you need to specify, and does the power source is going to also impact certifications and what certifications you're going to need, because obviously if you're powering this from an AC outlet, then that requires different specifications than a lithium battery versus an alkaline. You want to know these, the power sources needs to be one of the main things that you specify. And then if it is battery operated, whether rechargeable or disposable, then what type of battery life are you looking for? Then that will determine, you know, the size of the battery. And this obviously also plays with the size of the product and how critical that is. When looking at battery life, if the product is always on, then when it's always into a certain mode of operation, then that makes estimating the battery life a lot simpler. If anytime it's turned on, it's always draining 10 milliamps, then that becomes a really simple calculation to estimate the battery life or the battery capacity that's needed. But in more complicated products where certain features are going to be on part of the time, other features will be on at different times, it may have a wireless functionality that transmits information, say once every 5 minutes or once every 10 minutes, all these things impact the battery life and make it a lot more complicated to estimate and the needed battery capacity. In these cases, what you need to do is you need to specify use cases. Instead of saying, I want my battery life to last for 20 hours, you have to say, I want it to last for 20 hours, assuming that the GPS is turned on 10% of the time, that the accelerometer is on for 20% of the time, it communicates information wirelessly through cellular, maybe once every 10 minutes or something. You need to specify the exact use cases, and you can have multiple ones. And this is going to be something that's going to be up to you to specify it and not the designer, because you know how the product will be used better than the designer, or at least you should. Next is the processing performance requirements. If your product is going to be processing a lot of video data, for instance, and you're doing machine vision, then that requires a lot higher processing capabilities than you're transmitting temperature reading through Bluetooth Low Energy. You really need to specify as much as possible what type of processing requirements are required. First of all, you'll need to specify it to a level so that you can differentiate whether you'll need a microprocessor or a microcontroller. Microprocessor has a lot faster processing capabilities. You can kind of think of it, you know, as a computer or your cell phone processor capabilities. That's going to be a lot higher than a microcontroller as far as performance. But it's also a lot more complicated and a lot more expensive. If you can get by with a microcontroller, and keep in mind there are some very powerful microcontrollers out there, but if you can get by with a microcontroller versus a microprocessor, then it will just make development and everything that much smoother. But just be sure to determine up front whether, at the very least, if you need a microprocessor, which has an operating system like Linux or Android or Windows, versus a microcontroller, typically won't have an operating system. They can, but typically they won't have an operating system. Most of the components are embedded, like the RAM memory is embedded versus microprocessor. It's going to be external, which complicates the PCB design. You want to specify upfront the processing requirements for your product. If your product has a display, then you're going to want to specify the requirements for that display. How big of a display do you want? How many colors does it need? What's the resolution of it? Are you using it to play video or is this just plain text data? I would say there's a huge variety of different types of displays, everything from simple 7-segment LED displays that can only display alphanumeric versus full color LCD OLED screens. There's a huge variety in displays. You need to, first of all, find out what type of display your product needs for your requirements. And I've got a really good blog on that called Selecting the Display for Your Product that you can find on the Predictable Designs blog. And that's going to really help you fine tune what type of display that you need. But then once you've selected the display technology, then you'll also need to further specify that into the size, the resolution, the colors. And keep in mind that a display, especially a complex display, will be one of the main drivers of cost and power consumption. This is really critical to specify and to not over-design. If you're just displaying, you know, need to display some character text, then you don't need a full color LCD screen. Just be sure you don't over-design in this case because you'll pay the price in unit cost and power consumption. If your product has wireless capabilities, then you're going to want to specify the range, the wireless range. This can be either specified as line of sight, which means there's no obstacles between the receiver and the transmitter. Just think outside, a straight line distance between the two. Or you can specify more real world conditions that you want it to operate in a house through 5 walls, that type of thing. You want to specify that up front. That's going to help determine the type of wireless functionality that you need. Obviously, you need to transmit miles. That's going to be a totally different solution than you need to transmit just a few feet. That needs to be known up front. And then also there are, within each type of wireless protocol, you can increase the distance or the range through different design solutions. For instance, Bluetooth low energy, typically people are just Bluetooth in general, but you think of maybe 50 to 100 feet operating range. But there are long range Bluetooth solutions that have a line of sight range up to a kilometer. Don't always use the operating range to select your wireless technology, and some different technologies have different range capabilities depending on the specific solution. And keep in mind, once again, that range is going to tie directly into battery capacity, which can tie into product size. Just if you need a higher operating range and you need a higher transmission rate, then that's going to take a lot of power, which is going to mean a bigger battery, which means a bigger product. Just keep that in mind. Also, you'll want to specify the number of discrete devices in your product. For instance, if your product has 2 devices, one is a transmitter device, say it sensor data, and it transmits it to another device that you have as a receiver device. Now you have 2 separate products, and this is in many ways like developing 2 separate products. Do keep this in mind. It's like, although you may sell this as one product and you think of it as one product, from a development standpoint, if your product really is made up of 2 discrete devices, each with their own enclosure that are completely separated from each other, then that's like developing 2 separate products. If possible, I always recommend that you try to minimize the number of separate product devices required for your product. For instance, instead of having a receiver device, can that just instead be someone's smartphone or tablet? Then that allows you to eliminate one of the devices and essentially cut your development cost and your time to market and everything in half by getting rid of one of the devices. You'll also want to specify product appearance. You can obviously, if you have sketches or any other specifications that you want to specify in regards to the appearance, that's going to be really helpful. Also, you want to prioritize the appearance. How important is the appearance for your product? That's going to just to help you estimate how the cost to develop the enclosure. If appearance is really critical, then enclosure design tends to take a long time and be expensive because there's so much back and forth required between you and your designer when it's qualitative things like the appearance of the product. That's difficult for the designer to necessarily judge to the same level that you do. Just keep that in mind versus things that are more concrete, I want Bluetooth and I want it to communicate with a range of 100 meters, that's much more concrete and something that can be specified, versus appearance is very qualitative and tends to add a lot of time. Just be sure that you specify upfront how critical the appearance is for your product. Then, does your product have any mobile app requirements? A big percentage of the products that I see obviously have some type of wireless communication that communicate with the smartphone. What are your requirements for the app? You know, how, once again, is appearance for the app essential? Are you really concerned about the aesthetics of the app and having lots of pretty colorful graphics and such? All that just adds a lot of time and effort to the design. You want to know that up front and be able to rank how important the appearance of your mobile app is, or how complicated that you think it is. And then obviously you need to, with all software, you're going to need to specify as much as you can about what you want the app to do. What screens do you want it to have? What functions do you want it to have? You want to be sure that you list those out, but obviously keep that separate. Mobile app requirements, keep that separate from your hardware requirements or the firmware requirements. Next, we're going to look at the packaging specifications for your product. Don't forget, especially if you're going to be selling this in a retail environment, that your retail package is super critical. It's critical in a lot of situations, as critical as the product itself, because this is what, in a retail environment, is what has to convince the customer to buy your product, assuming they've not known about it ahead of time and seen your website and such. The retail package is extremely critical. You need to determine what kind of package do you want. Do you want just a clamshell, or do you want like a box? And if you want a box, then do you want a full color box with a plastic insert? And just keep in mind that a full color, really fancy retail box with plastic insert, they are extremely expensive and they will add a lot of cost to your product. It's generally not something I recommend that you start with, is doing that type of package. There's just so much money involved in it and complexity, and you don't really know yet what characteristics of your product are going to entice customers the most. Your messaging still needs work. You don't want to nail down your final package quite yet, because odds are you're going to want to change that once you get some market feedback. But you need to specify upfront what type of packaging you want, because that's going to impact the cost and the development. It's never as complicated as developing the product itself, obviously, but don't underestimate the complexity involved in designing a fancy package. Next, I suggest that you identify similar products. I always find it really helpful when someone presents a new product to me, especially if it's not one that's immediately obvious the function. It's really helpful if you have an example or a reference of a product that's similar. This can be really beneficial just to understanding the product, but also it can be helpful for shortcutting component selection, finding out. A lot of times you can get a teardown on the other product, the similar competing product, find out what solutions they used, and then take that and build on that. It can be really beneficial to have reference products to look at. You also want to specify the target country where this is going to be sold. And if multiple countries, then be sure to specify that. This becomes especially critical in regards to power. Obviously, some places use 50 hertz AC power, some places use 60 hertz, perhaps different voltages. You need to know that up front. In most cases, you can design it so that your product will work regardless of the, can work at both 50 or 60 hertz or the different voltage levels. But that's going to vary from country to country, so you need to make sure that you specify that up front. Same is true with wireless. Different countries have different requirements on wireless and what certifications are required and what frequency bands are permitted. You want to be sure to specify that up front and based on the country, because in some places that's going to drive the solution that your designer ends up selecting, because certain solutions just aren't viable in certain locations. And then finally, if your product, most of the products I see are typically electronically complex and mechanically quite simple. It tends to be an enclosure without any physical moving parts, except maybe a motor spinning or fan. But if your product does require any complex mechanical aspects, levers or different moving parts, or it folds up or then you need to specify that up front. And that's, you know, most likely going to mean that you need to bring on a mechanical engineer to help with those aspects. Okay, that is everything for step two, defining your product. Next, in step three, we're going to be looking at estimating all the costs to develop, scale, and manufacture your product. Okay, once you have validated your product and done the necessary upfront market research and you've defined the product, the next step is to estimate the cost going forward. I'm going to be breaking down the cost into three different stages. There will be development cost, there'll be scaling cost, which is the cost to take it from the prototype stage to being something that can be manufactured, and then finally there is the actual manufacturing cost of the product itself. The development and the scaling cost are upfront costs versus the manufacturing cost is the price that you will actually pay per unit of your product. The first costs that we're going to look into are the development cost. And this is going to be the first set of costs that you're typically going to run into. So we're going to break the development cost down into four sub costs that, depending on your product, you may not have all of these four different development costs, but generally most products will. The first cost is going to be the cost for the electronics design. This is the cost to design the schematic circuit diagram and design the printed circuit board layout. The next, we're going to have the software development cost. This will include the cost to develop the firmware, which is the software that's running internally on your device. It's called the firmware. This is the cost for the firmware and also the mobile app, if you happen to have one, or if you're product has a PC software, then that will also be included, obviously, in the software cost. Then third, we have the mechanical design cost. This is, for most products, the design of the enclosure that holds the electronics. This cost will be higher if you have a mechanically complicated product with moving parts and such, but the majority of products tend to have just a pretty simple non-moving stationary enclosure. This is a mechanical design. It can also be called industrial design or 3D modeling. It's essentially the design of the enclosure for your product. And then finally, the fourth stage of development that a lot of people forget about is the development of the retail package. If you're going to be selling your product online, this isn't nearly as critical as if you're going to sell it in a retail environment. But if you plan on selling your product in a retail environment, then the development of your retail package is extremely critical. Sometimes it can be almost as important as the product itself, since it's what has to get the customer to actually purchase the product. It's very critical. So don't neglect the retail packaging design. Now, the exact cost of these different stages of development will obviously depend on your product. Some products may be, you know, mechanically more complicated than they are electronically. In that case, the mechanical design would likely cost more to develop than the electronics design. But also with software, you can have this in any different combination depending on the product, but you may have a product that's, you know, relatively straightforward from an electronics design perspective, but the software is really complicated. So there are lots of different ways the cost can be split up among these different stages depending on your specific product. I would say in general, most of the products that I see, the electronics design tends to be a little bit more than the software design, but a lot of times they can be pretty equivalent, pretty close in their total cost. Although I think for most products, I would, you know, say that the hardware design is 20 to 30% more than the software design. These are very rough figures I'm just giving you so you have some idea of how these different costs, how they relate to each other. Electronics and software tends to be the more complicated the electronics, the more complicated the software required to program those electronics. That's why software and the hardware design tend to kind of correlate together and are somewhat typically pretty close to being similar price. The mechanical design for a typical product that doesn't have any moving parts, you know, I would say is going to be probably 2 to 4 times cheaper than the electronics design. It really depends on When it comes to the mechanical design of your product, the mechanical complexity, does it have moving parts that have to fit together perfectly? That is going to be a really big aspect of how much it's going to cost. And then also appearance. Is appearance for your product really critical? Because if it is, appearance is really difficult to convey to a designer. I find that if appearance is really critical, that's more qualitative. It's difficult for you to describe exactly what you're visualizing to the designer. It tends to require a lot of back and forth communication between you and the designer. If appearance is really critical, plan on the mechanical design taking longer than it would if appearance isn't quite as critical for your product as it is for other products. The development costs are broken down into those four stages, but that's kind of just the raw development. For instance, the electronics, that's generating the schematic circuit diagram, generating the printed circuit board layout, but you still have to make sure all this stuff works, and no product design ever is perfect the first time. You always have to, first of all, you have to prototype the design, and then you have to test and debug the prototypes. And then based on what you find from those prototypes, then you'll make improvements to your original design, you'll iterate it, and you'll prototype it again. And you just keep going through this cycle of prototyping, testing and debug, iterating the design, and then you go through that cycle until you get something that meets the goals that you're looking for. As far as prototypes, though, there are going to be various prototypes. The electronics, the printed circuit board, is going to require its own prototype. So you'll go through a PCB prototype shop or manufacturer to produce your printed circuit boards prototypes. In general, a printed circuit board prototype is, really similar to a mass manufactured printed circuit board, assuming you go through a company that has automatic placement machines that does everything automated as far as the assembly, soldering all the components onto the board. The other part that you're going to have to prototype is the mechanical design, so the enclosure. And this will typically be done through 3D printing, or you may do CNC machining. And then you may get into like some soft molding once you kind of get a little bit further along and you're wanting to produce more than a few units. The mechanical design will have to be prototyped, obviously, separately from the electronics. And typically 3D printing is going to be your most common choice there. And once again, if appearance is really critical for your product and you anticipate needing quite a few revisions on the enclosure design, then you may want to investigate purchasing your own 3D printer instead of outsourcing those prototypes, because it will allow you to iterate so much quicker. You can have a design on your computer, and then within hours you can have that holding in your hand, and there's so much information that you can gain from that and quickly iterate your design. Within one day, you could iterate your design multiple times, whereas if you're sending that off to a prototype shop each time and there's days of them manufacturing the prototype and days of shipping, then that's gonna really slow down your learn cycle. Anything you can do to speed up the prototyping process is going to speed up how fast you can get your product to market. And then, as I said, testing and debug. No product is ever going to be perfect the first time. I can guarantee you the first printed circuit board is not the one that you'll go to mass production with. The first enclosure design is not the one you'll go to mass production with. You have to prototype, and you have to test, and you have to debug any problems that you find during that testing process. And just be warned, this is the stage that typically is the most complicated to forecast in terms of time and money. Because by its nature, when you're debugging an issue, you're dealing with an unknown. If it was a known problem, then you would have made sure that it didn't exist in the original design. When you get those first prototypes back, it's totally unknowns. Obviously, you think you've got everything working right. If you knew there was a problem, you would have fixed it before you prototyped. When you do find a problem, by the very nature, you're not going to likely know what that problem is or immediately how to fix it. And sometimes it can take a long time to figure out what the problem is. A lot of times fixing it's maybe not quite as difficult to forecast, but the actual figuring out what the problem is can be really difficult to forecast how long it will take. And obviously that time is money, especially if you're outsourcing this. So that will impact the cost as well. It really tends to be the most challenging aspect. And this is true for regardless of whether you're a startup or you're a big tech company. I've seen, you know, lots of projects with really big tech companies get bogged down once they get their first version back and they find problems with it, and trying to find those problems and figure out what the root cause of those problems are is challenging to forecast. Just expect that this stage may take you longer to forecast. Now, I find designing a schematic circuit, if you have a really solid product definition, designing the schematic circuit, most designers can tell you within weeks of, you know, perhaps days, how long that will take them to do. The same is true with the printed circuit board. Those are very concrete steps, whereas the testing, debug, and iterating your prototype is where it becomes more challenging to forecast exactly how long that's going to take. Just keep that in mind. Once you have a completed prototype and you've gone through the process of iterating the prototype and debugging it and testing it, and now you finally have gotten to what you believe is a final prototype and is one that's, there may be a few minor issues, but in general, once you get to the stage of, okay, I've got a prototype that is 99% of the way being ready for manufacturing. And that's a huge milestone to reach, to having a production quality prototype, something that you can present to investors or potential customers and you get feedback on it because it's production quality. Where a lot of entrepreneurs run into problems is they incorrectly assume that making one unit is the same as making 1,000 units, is the same as making 100,000 units, is the same as making 1,000,000 units. And that's not the case. Although making 1,000,000 and 100,000 are a lot more similar than making one versus making 1,000. This is the stage, the scaling stage, that I think tends to be one of the areas that entrepreneurs kind of skip over or neglect the most. They feel like once they get to a prototype stage, I've got a prototype, now it's just a matter of giving this to a manufacturer and saying, hey, make a bunch of these and I can sell them and everything's easy after that. And that is so not the case. For most projects, it tends to take almost as long to go from the prototype stage to having mass manufacturing totally up and ready and running smoothly as it does to go from idea to prototype. Just keep that in mind. Once you're to the prototype stage, the final prototype stage, you're kind of about halfway to being ready for manufacturing. Don't underestimate the work and the time that goes into setting up manufacturing once you have that one prototype. We're going to look at a few of the costs that are related to this scaling process. And one of the first ones is electrical certifications, which I'll go into more detail on the next slide. But electrical certifications are getting your product FCC certified if you're in the US, or getting the UL certification if you're in the US and your product plugs into an AC electrical outlet, or CE certification if you're in Europe. There are lots of different certifications, and every country or region has their own certification requirements, but pretty much any place is going to require some type of certification on an electrical product, just whether that be for safety, which is like a UL certification. You don't want, you know, your product to someone to plug it in and then you burn their house down. It's a lot of it is for safety. And there's also, especially if you have a wireless product, but even if you don't, there's government organizations in the US, it's FCC, that wants to make sure your product doesn't interfere with other forms of wireless communication. You're going to require electrical certifications. These are not necessarily cheap. You're typically talking at least $10,000 to get your product electrically certified. There are lots of shortcuts and tips that you can do to minimize the cost of certifications, and I'll go into some of those on the next slide. In addition to electrical certifications, you also have the manufacturing setup. And the biggest part of that are going to be your injection molds. There'll be some setup fees for getting the manufacturing process set up to manufacture your printed circuit boards. and things like that. But there'll be like assembly fixtures to hold your product while it's being put together. But typically those are, you're talking hundreds or maybe $1,000 or something. It's fairly small amounts compared to the biggest financial obstacle to go from one unit to selling thousands or millions of units are injection molds, which are what are required for the enclosure on your design. Scaling from making a couple electronics, the printed circuit boards, up to millions, that there's still a lot of issues with scaling. I'm not implying that going from one PCB to a million PCBs is trivial. The problem that what you find is, as you increase your production volume, new problems will show up. Let's say only one out of 100 units has a certain problem, you know, so 1%. But if you're only running 10 units, then odds are you're not even going to ever see that problem. And so as you keep ramping up the volume, you'll new problems will come up. That will be one of the main obstacles with scaling the electronics. But with the electronics, the advantage is the same general process is used to make your prototypes, one or two or three or four or five units, prototype quantities as are used for production. Assuming you're not hand soldering your own printed circuit boards, but if you're sending them to a PCB prototype shop that's making your boards and then using automated equipment to pick and place and solder the components on the board, then that process is going to be really similar to the process for mass manufacturing. There's not a tremendous amount of setup cost that goes from setting up doing prototypes to mass manufacturing. It's typically going to be hundreds of dollars for the setup cost for the electronics. The problem, but the biggest part of the headache comes with the enclosure, which is something when you're focusing on an electronic hardware product, most people are focused on the electronics. But when it comes to scaling it, the enclosure is what can be the biggest obstacle, because it's completely different technology that you use to prototype versus what you use for mass manufacturing of custom shaped plastic pieces. You'll use 3D printing or CNC machining when you're doing the prototype process. And those, you're typically talking hundreds of dollars to get some prototypes made using those technologies. But those technologies are only good for small volume prototype quantities. You're not going to use 3D printing, at least not yet. Hopefully one of these days we'll move into 3D printing being used for manufacturing. But right now it's only used for prototyping. Instead, for manufacturing, you have to use injection molding. First of all, there's a big time commitment to go from, it's much easier to design a part that can be 3D printed than it is to design one that can be injection molded. You can almost 3D print about anything you can create, versus you're not going to be able to injection mold any shape that you can come up with. You're going to have to make a lot of design accommodations for it to work for injection molding. And that takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of experience with injection molding. Just keep that in mind when you're doing the scaling process. But the biggest obstacle isn't necessarily the time to get your product ready for injection molding. It's simply the cost of the injection molds. For a really low cost, low volume injection mold, something that can make thousands of units, maybe up to 10,000 units, you're talking a couple thousand dollars for each mold. Minimum, your product is going to require two custom plastic pieces, a top side and a bottom side. Rarely can they be identical. They have to have snaps or something that fit together. It will typically be two different pieces. That means you're going to require two different molds, and each of those molds is going to be a few thousand dollars. There are ways to reduce that through what is called a family mold. And a family mold allows you to have more than one part molded in the same mold. You could have your top side and your bottom side. Problem is, there are a lot of family molds tend to be okay for moderate to low volume production, but generally they're not a good solution for really high volume production. They add some extra complexities to the production process. For one thing, the two parts that are in the family mold have to be very similar in size. How long it takes the plastic to fill up that cavity to form that part has to be the same. It just adds further design limitations on you using a family mold, but it can be a great way to reduce your upfront cost when you're first doing your first production runs, but eventually you'll want to phase those out. But you have to remember, so at least eventually you're going to require a separate mold for each plastic piece in your product. And that's the simplest is going to be two pieces, but there's plenty of products that have 10 custom plastic pieces. Once you add up every little custom plastic piece inside, just keep that in mind. And that's one of the best ways you can reduce your scaling costs is to reduce the number of plastic, custom shaped plastic pieces that your product requires, because that's going to set the number of molds. And that's going to set a big part of the manufacturing setup cost or the scaling cost is going to be the cost of those molds. Because they're only a couple thousand dollars when you're doing, you know, low volumes. But by the time you get up to molds that can produce hundreds of thousands or perhaps millions of units, then you can easily get into cost of tens of thousands of dollars or more. There's molds that cost $100,000. So they can get really, really expensive. Anything you can do to reduce the number of molds that your project requires will go a long way in reducing your scaling costs and the time that it takes you to scale your product. Okay, now we're going to look at some of the different electrical certifications that may be required. Now, I'm going to be specifically focusing on mainly at the U.S., Canada, and Europe, which are the markets that I have the most experience with in regards to certifications. But keep in mind that every country tends to have their own regulations and certifications required for electrical products. So if you're in a country that's not or selling in, it's not where you're located, it's where you'll be selling the product. But if you're going to be selling your product outside of the US, Canada, or Europe, then you'll need to look into the regulations required for those specific countries. But in general, most countries tend to have very similar certifications to the ones that we're going to be discussing. So the first one is the FCC certification, which is required to make sure that your product doesn't interfere with wireless communication. That's the function of the FCC certification. And there are two types of FCC certification depending on your product. There's one called an intentional radiator certification and a non-intentional radiator certification. An intentional radiator is a product that's intentionally radiating RF waves. Anything with wireless communication, whether a cell phone or Bluetooth or Wi-Fi, those are all intentional radiators. They're intentionally radiating out RF waves. A non-intentional radiator is a product that perhaps has a microcontroller running in it, but it's no wireless functionality is intended. But it's, you know, no Bluetooth, no Wi-Fi, nothing like that. It's just a self-contained product. However, if it has anything in it oscillating above 9 kilohertz, which is going to be the case for most microcontrollers or typically in megahertz, anything above 9 kilohertz will require it to be certified as a non-intentional radiator. It's a certification that's for a product that's not intentionally radiating. A product that's not designed to radiate is not going to radiate nearly as much as a product that's designed to radiate. There are different levels of certification, and it's more expensive to get the intentional radiator certification. Kind of a starting price you can look at for an intentional radiator FCC certification is a minimum of about $10,000, whereas you can get a non-intentional FCC certification for closer to $3,500 or around $3,000 to $4,000. A lot of this cost depends on how well you do. If you pass the test the first time, then that is going to be a lot lower cost. But if you have to, you have some issues that come up in the first test, then that requires you to tweak your design to compensate for those, and then you have to retest it, then that can tends to add a lot of extra cost. Obviously, the $3,000 to $4,000 for non-intentional or the $10,000 plus for intentional radiator are sort of just the starting points, assuming that everything goes well. However, there is fortunately a way around the requirement for intentional radiator certification, even if your product intentionally radiates, and that is to use a pre-certified module. For any part of your product that is an intentional radiator, a Bluetooth radio, a Wi-Fi radio, cellular service, then you would use a module solution that's already been FCC certified. Therefore, that allows you to only certify your product as a non-intentional radiator, because the only parts that haven't been certified of your product are the non-intentional radiating parts. The intentional radiating part has already been certified because you're using a pre-certified module. So that can be one good way to reduce your FCC cost. But it's really difficult to completely eliminate FCC costs because very few products can oscillate at only, 9 kilohertz or less. Now, there are some applications where you could potentially have a microcontroller. There are various microcontrollers that allow you to use a clock frequency of only a few kilohertz. If you have a really, basic slow application, you could potentially run a microcontroller below 9 kilohertz and then avoid FCC certification entirely. The other certification that is commonly needed in the U.S. is called UL, or Underwriters Laboratory Certification. You'll see this on a lot of products that you buy. Typically, anything that plugs into an AC electrical outlet requires this UL certification, and it's essentially a safety certification. It wants to make sure that your product's not going to blow up or catch somebody's house on fire. And regardless, even if this... And let me just say also that UL is not legally required. There's no law that says if your product plugs into an AC outlet in the US, you have to have UL certification. But to be quite blunt, you would be really stupid to sell a product that plugs into an AC outlet without having this certification, because don't focus just on the certification itself, but going through that process of getting that certification makes your product safer. It improves your product. And I know we all want to develop safe products. No one wants to be responsible for thinking their product has injured someone. Even if you could bypass it, UL certification is still, you would still want to do it if your product plugs into an AC electrical outlet. And also, if you're going to sell your product through any of the large retail chains, they're definitely going to require UL certification. And in fact, they may require it even if your product doesn't plug into an AC electrical outlet, just because they want to cover their bases and be safe. So keep that in mind. It's not a requirement, but if your device plugs into AC outlet, then you absolutely want to have it, and you'll have to have it if you're going to sell through any retail chains, and even perhaps if the product doesn't plug into an AC outlet. Now, one trick around this UL certification, which again, if your product plugs into an AC outlet, you're probably looking at a starting cost of about $10,000 to get this certification. One common trick that I like to use is to move the AC to DC conversion function outside of your product. Instead of having your product plug into an AC outlet, and then inside your product, you take that AC and you convert it down to a 5-volt DC signal, and then you use that to maybe recharge a battery or to completely power your product. Instead, use a wall wart or a wall adapter or a USB charger, the things that we all use that plug to use to charge our phone. And what that does is that's doing all the AC to DC conversion in that brick that plugs into the wall, and your product only sees 5-volt DC or a DC signal. But in that type of situation, your product doesn't require the UL certification, but the adapter does. What you do is, instead of designing your own AC to DC conversion, you use a pre-certified module. This pre-certified module will allow you to power your product from AC, but yet your part of the design, the custom part that's not been certified, never sees the AC voltage. And then that just allows you to kind of skip over and not require the UL certification. That's a really common trick, especially if your product is it's going to be rechargeable, has a rechargeable battery, then everyone, and you can buy them so cheap, are just USB wall chargers that output 5-volt DC, and they're already FCC and CE certified. So you wouldn't have to have any UL certifications. That's really helpful. CSA is a Canadian certification that's equivalent to the UL certification if your product plugs into an AC electrical outlet. I know the US will accept CSA certification, or US retailers will accept CSA certification. And then likewise, Canadian retailers will accept a UL certification. They're very similar. The CSA certification, I believe, tends to be a little bit cheaper than UL certification. That could be an option for you if you happen to need this certification. It could be an option to save a little bit of money for you. Fourth, we have the CE certification. This is what's required in the European Union, and it's essentially a combination of FCC and UL testing. It's got our certifications. It's got some other stuff in it. So that's going to be strictly for the EU. And that has a, you know, kind of a similar starting price of $10,000 plus to get certified. Then we have the ROHS certification, which just certifies that your product is free of lead. And that's currently only required in the EU and the state of California. To my knowledge, no other states in the US, and definitely the US federal, doesn't require ROHS or lead-free certification. But California is a massive economy. They're essentially like, they have their own, they're ranked in the, I don't know their ranking, but they're really high in the world as far as just their economy alone. They're huge. They're like their own country. And so if you're going to sell your product anywhere in the US, the odds are you're going to also want to sell it in California. You're going to want this certification. And fortunately, this is a fairly low cost certification to get. You're talking roughly about $1,000. It's not nearly as expensive as FCC or UL or CE certifications. And then the last one I'm going to talk about is IEC certification. In particular, there's one that I deal with a lot called the IEC 62133. And this is a certification that's required on rechargeable lithium ion batteries. We all know how, at least I think most of us know how dangerous lithium ion batteries can be, from the Samsung phones catching on fire and exploding a couple years ago. We all, I think, have fresh in our mind the dangers of lithium ion batteries. They require safety certifications. And previously there was a certification called a UL 1642 that was used, but that's been mostly replaced by the IEC 62133 certification. And just one quick note, you'll notice I mentioned another UL certification. It's quite an oversimplification to say that UL only does a certification if your product plugs into an electrical outlet, because the UL, they have hundreds of different certifications that they do. But I don't want to oversimplify that, and they have all their different certifications that they offer. That's something that you can look up. I don't want to oversimplify that too much, but the UL 1642 was what was previously used for rechargeable batteries, but that's been replaced by the IEC 62133 certification. And one way around this is to purchase pre-certified lithium-ion batteries. And then that would allow you to get around this certification for the battery being certified. You'll still need UN 38.3 certification to ship a lithium ion battery. That's another low cost certification, but that's not for the battery itself. As long as you purchase a pre-certified lithium ion battery, then you won't require the IEC certification. You won't have to get that done. Just make sure you find a battery that already has that certification. The one case where you'll need to have this done is if your product requires a custom designed battery. If you're trying to squeeze as much battery capacity into a small product size, then you need a battery that's custom shaped to fill in every little, take maximum advantage of the space that's available. You'll want to have a custom battery designed, and if you do that, then you'll have to pay for this certification. But as long as you're using a stock off-the-shelf battery, just be sure to try to find one that's already got this necessary certification. Okay, that's an overview of the various electrical certifications that you'll need. Now we're going to jump into the manufacturing unit cost. So everything we've looked at up until now has been upfront cost, or one-time, non-recurring cost. the cost you're going to pay up front, but once you're manufacturing the product, they're kind of done. They're just a one-time fee versus the manufacturing unit cost, which I argue is the most important cost because it's the one you have to live with forever. It's the one that sets your profit margins, your retail price, and it also sets your inventory price. Eventually, once you're ready to place your first manufacturing order, then obviously the cost of that order is going to be the cost, the unit cost times how many units you're going to order. This is going to set your cost for inventory, which, as you'll find out eventually, that's a huge obstacle because of cash flow issues. And cash flow is always really important for hardware startups. It's really important to know up front how much your inventory is going to cost so that you can properly plan on, you know, how you're going to raise that funding or finance your inventory. And to be able to estimate that, you have to start by estimating your unit manufacturing cost. And unfortunately, I find that most designers, most entrepreneurs, they wait until they've completely designed the product to begin thinking about manufacturing cost. And that's not the way to do it, because then it's too late to make any adjustments. You've already designed the product, or it's not necessarily too late, but making those changes will take a lot more effort and a lot more time than if you had just considered the cost from the very beginning.